says, I vow that when I attain enlightenment in a future age, if there are limitless and boundless sentient beings who cultivate and practice the pure conduct of my teaching, I will cause them all to be able to follow perfectly the rules of conduct and be complete in the three cumulative precepts. Those who slander and offend will, after hearing my name, be able once again to attain purity, and they will not sink to a woeful existence. Okay, so this is emphasizing the importance of pure ethical conduct, taking and keeping the precepts, abandoning the 10 destructive actions, and so on. Okay, so those who cultivate and practice the pure conduct, you know, following cause and effect as the Buddha taught, that the medicine Buddha will cause them or inspire them to be able to follow perfectly the rules of conduct. Okay? And to complete the three cumulative precepts. I'm not really sure what the three cumulative precepts are. My first reaction was to think, you know, the Pratimoksha, Bodhisattva, and Tantric, except Medicine Buddha doesn't have the Tantric vows. So I don't know why that would be included here. It could be the three kinds of ethical conduct that you find in the Lamrim, of abandoning harmful actions, creating positive ones, and benefiting sentient beings. But I'm not sure, actually. So, unquestioned that, marked by the three cumulative precepts. But anyway, to be able to follow perfectly the rules of conduct. It's interesting, we have in let's say our monastic vows or even the lay precepts that you have precepts that are made because some actions are naturally negative, and then precepts, well actually, let's put this another way, scratch that. Actions which are negative because they're naturally negative, and actions in which you accumulate negative karma because you're going against a prohibitive precept established by the Buddha. Okay? So for example, you know, killing, stealing, immoral sexual behavior, and lying, whether you do those or not, or whether you have precepts or not, you accumulate negative karma if you do those. Because those actions, because the motivation is usually negative, then those produce painful results. Okay. Other actions like singing, dancing, playing music, taking intoxicants, not eating, you know, in the afternoon, these kinds of things. Those, in and of themselves, are not naturally negative actions. In other words, people can do those with a neutral motivation. Very often they do them with an attached motivation, but they can also be done with a neutral one. And so they aren't naturally negative because of the motivation. But the Buddha made precepts regarding those things as a way of protecting the mind against other things that could make you do the naturally negative precepts, or the naturally negative actions. Okay, don't get actions and precepts confused here, like I am when I'm talking. They're clear in my mind, but my speech is not so quick. So the prohibitive precepts are made as like a fence, okay? So if you don't have the precept to abandon singing, dancing, and playing music, you sing and dance and play music. It's not necessarily negative. Maybe, it may not be. Okay? If you take that precept, then if you sing, dance, or play music, yeah, because you're contradicting a precept that you chose to do, yeah, then it puts a negative effect on your mind. Now, there are certain circumstances where you can ask the Buddha's permission, you know, to do those things because, and this is according to the Bodhisattva precepts, because there's a higher aim of benefiting sentient beings. When you talk to people from the Theravada tradition, they say you just keep the precepts black and white, literally, that's it. Basta finito, okay? When you take the Bodhisattva precepts on top of that, then when you look at, like, the five precepts of the monastic vows. When you look at the prohibited precepts, there are certain circumstances where, for the benefit of sentient beings, it's better, you know, not to keep that literally. There may even be certain circumstances where it may be better to do the actions which are naturally negative if you have the bodhisattva vows, but you have to definitely be highly realized in order to do that. Okay? So there are certain circumstances, you know, where things can change, but I think it's very helpful to know the difference between things that are naturally negative and things that become negative because you've taken a prohibitive precept, because the latter, you know, if situations deem it necessary out of compassion or for some other reason that's a good reason, those ones are easier to request permission to contradict, okay, than the ones that are naturally negative. Because the ones that are naturally negative, you really have to cultivate a good motivation to kill, you know, purely. Okay, I mean, you really have to have bodhicitta to be able to do that. Okay? Are you on the same page with me? Okay. So, Buddha is encouraging us here to keep good ethical conduct. You're on a page behind or ahead. What?
Example of a situation where you could have a positive motivation for
sitting. Well, the usual example that's given here is from the Buddha's past life when he was a bodhisattva, and he was the captain of a ship that had 500 merchants on it. And he saw through his clairvoyant powers that one of the merchants was going to kill the other 499 and abscond with their stuff. So he had compassion not only for the 499 who were going to be killed, but especially for the one who was going to accumulate all the negative karma of killing. And so he thought, I will take the negative karma upon myself of killing this one so that he doesn't get that negative karma, and also so that the others don't lose their lives. Okay? So because of his complete willingness to take on the suffering result, then it actually became something that was very strong purification for him. Okay? So you see that you have to be pretty highly realized to do that. Yeah, it's easier at our level. Like I was telling you before, when I go to see my parents, I watch TV. Well, actually, I have a precept not to watch entertainment, but it's, you know, not to, that's what the singing, dancing, and playing music precept is essentially about. Yeah, I mean, that's, they didn't have TV in those days, and, you know, cinema and discos and the whole thing. But, you know, if you want to update that precept, that's basically what it means. Yeah. But when I go home to, you know, when I go to visit my parents, then, I mean, it just wouldn't be very nice if I never talked to them, because I wouldn't sit in front of the television. And if you want to talk to them, that's where you have to be. So, you know, I have, you know, I say, Buddha, this is, you know, what I'm going to do. And Buddha says, go ahead. Yeah. Okay. So it's that kind of situation. Yeah. Okay. And the Buddha's also saying in this vow that, you know, if people fall from their ethical discipline, yeah, then by hearing his name, they will once again be able to attain purity. So I don't think this means literally that you just hear the name Medicine Buddha. I think hear the name means something deeper, you know, inside of themselves. If they hear, you know, if they hear kind of the feeling of what it means to keep ethical discipline and have some regret for what they do and have a new aspiration to keep their discipline. I think that's what hearing the name means.
Yeah. I believe in people's right to make decisions about what they do with their life.
Yeah.
Now, let's say if I was an artist-like person and I saw roughly a position that, if I kill that position, I get paid over the course of that position's career span. I mean, if they did 10 abortions a day and you work 200 days a year, that's 2,000 abortions times, I don't know, 30 years. It's a lot of lives I could spend. So if I eliminate the position, the feeling that I'm honestly saving these people, I can imagine that your responsibility, but my motivation is to have wrong view. That I'm not actually taking that doctor's things on to me.
Right.
And that's really different.
Right. And also you're doing it with a self-righteous attitude. You're not doing it out of compassion. You're doing it out of anger.
You could argue that when you're hurting it out of compassion.
But it's not, when you do this kind of thing, you have to have compassion for everybody.
You could say that you're saving the condition from
yourself. Well, if somebody was really a bodhisattva, you know, perhaps that bodhisattva might do that. The rest of the people who bomb abortion clinics, I have doubts about. Yeah.
It could be a fine line between someone who has a great deal of emotions towards, their children.
But, see, that's the thing. If you just have this kind of ushy-gushy emotion, that's not compassion. Yeah, when you have compassion in these situations, it has to be for everybody in the situation. And you have to be willing to undergo the suffering yourself. Okay? It can't be, like 30 years ago when the doctor was sick, when the kids are born, I have so much ushy-gushy compassion, but when they grow up to be abortion doctors, I want to kill them. Something's wrong. Okay. Okay, go on. Okay. The sixth one. I vow that when I attain enlightenment in a future age, if there are sentient beings whose bodies are inferior, whose sense organs are impaired, who are ugly, stupid, deaf, blind, mute, bent, and lame, hunchback, leprous, convulsive, insane, or who have all sorts of diseases and sufferings, such beings, when they hear my name, shall obtain proper appearance and practical intelligence. All their senses will become perfect, and they will have neither sickness nor suffering. Okay, so this is really what the medicine Buddha is famous for. Okay? I call him how he got his name. Okay, so, these are all conditions in which people have a lot of suffering right now, if they have them. And they also act as impediments to Dharma practice, too. Yeah. But some of these aren't such impediments now as they were before. For example, being deaf or blind, at the time of the Buddha, it was a super big impediment to practicing Dharma. Now it's not so bad because they have sign language, you have Braille, okay? It still makes it difficult, but it's not quite as bad. Yeah. Other things, there might be very physical suffering, or there might be suffering because of being of the way society looks at you, For example, lepers. Okay? I mean, leprosy has its own physical suffering and what happens to your sense or, your organs and things like that. But even more than, or in addition to that, you have the suffering of being an outcast by society. Okay? And so, some of them you have the mental plus the physical. Now, the same thing with people who are handicapped. It doesn't say that specifically in here, but I think, bent and lame, I guess, could include that. But you have the, the physical pain, you have the physical inconvenience, and then you have what society does to you on top of it. Yeah, all of which create a whole amalgam of, problems. And so the Buddha is, saying that they will have, proper appearance and practical intelligence. And I think, Well, I guess by having the proper appearance, then you no longer face what society does to you. Okay? But it seems to me also implicit in here is saying something to people who don't have those particular impediments this lifetime, that they should be more compassionate to the people who do, and not just, you know, kick them out of society or, you know, be afraid of them. Yeah? And in, not only that, but in addition, do things that help, you know, alleviate the actual pain. Okay, so this includes mental illness as well as physical illness. Any questions about this one? Yeah?
This is where we're spice prejudice and also someone who is gay. Yeah, it was special.
Probably, yeah. I mean, it's the whole same meaning of, you know, reaching out with compassion to everybody. Right. Yeah.
I'm not sure how to frame this question because it kind of comes off a little bit of the last question, and that's the sort of status quo against which it's kind of what you were saying about these are people not accepted by society.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can see the age one kind of fitting in here too, and yes, we have to deal with our minds in response to what we are dealing with in the world. But sometimes I start looking for more, like, well, then, what about the society that throws these people out? That's why I'm having trouble forming the question. I'm kind of sort of engaged with this question, but.
What's the question?
That's what I'm trying to find.
She lost her question.
It's like bumping up against the society that would call somebody ugly.
Uh-huh.
And like, why couldn't you say change society or something? That's a pretty good broad way of saying it. You know, I mean, some of these definitions are based on what society is saying are
uh-huh.
imperfect human beings,
uh-huh.
when in fact there's an, you know, the Adam all up and it's all of the human race.
If you want to add to that list, and those unfortunate beings who are narrow-minded and keys and social stereotypes, they have the audacity, you know, that that can be healed too, because that is a big an obstacle and
Yeah.
Because I guess it's a question of concern. You know, to be liberated from cycles of existence can almost become wanting to get away from the status quo because it's intolerable. It brings lots of suffering, and the Bodhisattva turns you back on it, which is great. But it concerns me because I can deal with my own mind from now until the cows come home over the status quo. And it's,
what do you mean you can deal with your own mind regarding the status quo?
Well, I can deal with my anger at, you know, the certain conditions of the world. I can deal with, you know, my difficulty with narrow-minded people. I can deal with my feelings about people who would like to kill me because I'm gay or want to abuse me because I'm a woman or, you know, just the social fabric that creates an enormous amount of work for me as a Buddhist.
Uh-huh.
And then I want to find in Buddhism, okay, well, then what do I do with the status quo?
You're right.
I want to add
the narrow
minded to this now.
Okay. Well, now you have your vow for when you generate bodhicitta. Okay. Yeah. And in some ways, yours fits into what we were talking about this morning about those with wrong views. Yeah. The people who would kick other people out of society because they find them different.
Mm-hmm.
So you're making a vow, may I help all those intolerant sentient beings who are closed-minded and prejudiced and discriminatory, and may I bring them to the right view.
And the right view is actions based on kindness, taking care of everybody, recognizing impermanence. Okay.
Yeah, recognizing that we've been born like that in the past, so what's the use of, you know, hating somebody or fearing somebody because of what they are when we've been that? And when there's a good chance we're going to be that again, especially if we have that kind of narrow-minded outlook against those people. I mean, that's the whole thing. It's very clear. Like it says in the scriptures, if you're really arrogant, then you get reborn as a slave. Okay? So it's that whole thing, you know, when you're intolerant, then you get reborn as the one that you're intolerant against, and you have to experience the result of what you dished out. So we better be careful.
Including
fanaticism
against
narrow-minded
people.
Yeah.
Hey, although narrow-minded people.
Well, that's the whole thing about compassion, you know? Okay, and that's, it relates to it. You have to have compassion to everybody in the situation, not just to the people that you perceive to be the victims. Yeah?
So that's why I wanted to talk about that one psychologist.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh. I feel like this is kind of lame.
Back to the poem that we received yesterday about Lama Zopa asking a young woman to apologize to her parents.
Better than lunch, isn't
it? Okay. So you're getting some sense here of how you come to your own vows, you know, the groups of people that you feel strongly about that you need to help. And then you should especially generate compassion towards those. Yeah. And so I think especially if you have an issue with people who are intolerant against you because of what you are, then you should especially try and generate compassion for those people and make a vow to be able to lead them on the correct path in the future. Yeah. And so that they don't get reborn in those kinds of situations because of their actions, and so that they come to realize, you know, what they're doing. Okay, and the seventh vow, I vow that when I attain enlightenment in a future age, if there are any sentient beings who are ill and oppressed, who have nowhere to go and nothing to return to, who have neither doctor nor medicine, neither relatives nor immediate family, who are destitute and whose sufferings are acute, as soon as my name passes through their ears, they will be cured of all their diseases, and they will be peaceful and joyous in body and mind. They will have plentiful families and property, and they will personally experience the Supreme Enlightenment. Okay? So I think this is kind of all of our wish, huh? Wouldn't it be so easy that all somebody had to do is hear my name, and this would come about? Yeah. But it's a way of, you know, you can see from a bodhisattva's viewpoint of saying, you know, I want this to come about so badly that, you know, maybe just hear my name and it come about. But, you know, may I also work day and night and do everything I possibly can by other means to make this happen. So here, I mean, you can really see so much of the suffering that's going on in the world, you know, between Rwanda and, you know, nothing to return to, and the Palestinians, and the inner city, and Littleton, and, you know, you name it. Okay? So, I think what's also interesting in this is, like, we can look at these beings and we can see their suffering and, you know, why they have reason for suffering, but often other people, we can't understand why they have suffering. Yeah? It looks, how to say, we look at people that we're jealous of, and we don't have compassion for them because it looks to us like they don't have any suffering. And yet if we look closer, they would have a lot of suffering. Yeah? Because the thing is that the mind creates suffering, no matter what you're doing. If you don't have physical suffering, your mind creates something to complain about. Yeah? I was thinking about the remark I made the other day about, you know, people having boring problems. And I was thinking about it because, you know, there are some situations that if somebody else tells us about the situation, we don't understand why they are suffering. Because, you know, when I was reading over the problems that people had, a lot of them were people needed, they faced a decision that they needed to make and they didn't know what to choose. And that was called a problem. And I was thinking, I usually call a problem where you have some kind of acute suffering. But then I realized for some people, making a decision is acute suffering. But it's only because their mind makes it suffering. Because the situation they're in isn't really one where they have to suffer. You know, if you're in the situation where you have to choose between apple juice and orange juice, you know, and you're sitting there going, you know, I don't know what to do. I mean, you're suffering inside. And somebody else looks at it and goes, what? Your suffering is totally self-created. What are you so stressed out about? There's apple juice and there's orange juice, and you're going to be happy either way. And you should be happy that you even have that choice between apple juice and orange juice. Because many people don't even have that choice. You know, there isn't any juice where they are. You know, there isn't any water where they are. But you can see that, you know, if the person had no water where they were, we could say that person has a problem and we would feel compassion. The person who has the choice between all the different luxury beverages and gets themselves all stewed up because they don't know which one to choose, you can see how that person's mind is creating suffering. Yeah, there isn't a lot of suffering in this situation. It's the mind that's creating the suffering. And yet, from that person's viewpoint, they're experiencing acute suffering. So I think it's an interesting thing here for us to look at and ask ourselves, you know, when do I have a real problem and when is my mind, you know, creating suffering for itself here?
I think there's another way to look at the people that wrote down that they were basically making a decision, and that is that they didn't really have a problem that had caused acute suffering. This was the biggest problem that they had. Someone in my group said, who had what seemed like a minor problem, said, "I feel like a whiner." My reaction was that you should rejoice that this was the most serious problem that you have.
I'm sure if we look a little bit deeper, we could find some other problems. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. If we looked at our life from a Dharma perspective, isn't being in cyclic existence a pretty big problem? Mm-hmm. Yeah? And if we looked at our life, you know, and the days when we are whiners and are complainers, to look and say, well, wait a minute, you know, is this such a big problem? Or, you know, my being in psychic existence is a much bigger problem. Why don't I pay attention to solving that one instead of, you know, getting myself bent out of shape because I don't know what kind of juice I want. Okay? Okay.
Yeah? Well, I was just going to comment about that exercise because I was thinking about that too.
Uh-huh.
Part of it might have been, some of us might think of problem not necessarily as including suffering. If you had said, write down your biggest suffering, we may have written something quite a bit different. But for some of us, problem kind of almost means decision. So you might get the result, if you say write down a problem of people putting a problem, which for me is like a decision. Mm-hmm. If you say, what is, you know, give an example of a situation which you're really suffering, you might choose something quite different.
Mm-hmm. So problem means decision?
Mm-hmm. Something to solve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Something to solve.
Like a one-question problem.
Dilemma.
Yeah, but I have a different meaning for the word. I mean, it's interesting.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Necessarily include suffering with problems.
You mean if you're suffering, you wouldn't call that a problem?
Yes. All suffering is a problem, but not all problems include suffering.
But when I ask people to talk about a problem they had, you didn't necessarily want to talk about the one that was your main concern. Okay, so next time I should ask for the biggest problem. Okay.
The thing is suffering. Or the situation in which you're suffering a lot.
And I was wondering why the problems were on the level that they were. Because what? But it's interesting. If we sat around at a party, then all the ones that were the big problems would come out. You know.
Yeah.
Okay.